Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. Donald Trump was declared the winner of the U.S. presidential election on November 8th, but that victory won't be official until Monday when 538 members of the Electoral College weigh in across the country. A small bipartisan group of those electors say they don't want to cast their votes until they hear from the National Intelligence Director on Russian interference in the election. Today, we'll talk with one of those electors and we'll consider the options available to the Electoral College. We'll also consider the role of dissent in a country that appears to be ripe for it after this news from NPR. Great to be with you. It's 6 minutes past the hour. We're so glad to have you with us today. Today, we continue our series of conversations we're calling After the Vote. And honestly, if you'd asked us to anticipate what we'd be talking about in these conversations, we would not have been able to imagine a scenario in which there are calls for both a congressional investigation and a delay in the vote of the Electoral College until more can be known about Russia's efforts to influence the election on behalf of the candidate who won. We could not have imagined the candidate who lost the Electoral College won the popular vote by the widest margin in history. We could not have imagined the president-elect would confirm that he gets the presidential briefing on a weekly as opposed to a daily basis and spent much of the weekend dismissing the intelligence community's findings. There has not yet been announced a plan to eliminate potential conflicts of interest between Mr. Trump's role as president and his extensive business empire. Some cabinet appointees have been described as hostile to the mission of the agencies they are set to lead. The president-elect hasn't had a news conference since July, rescheduled the one that was supposed to happen this Thursday to an unspecified date next month. All of this playing out in advance of Monday's vote in state capitals across the country, where the Electoral College, in the form of individual electors chosen on November 8th, will gather to take the final step in our two-step electoral process. We'll talk with an elector today who will do that job on Monday. And we want to hear what you're thinking about all of these issues today at 440-2665 or 1-800-940-2240. You can also check out our Facebook page as well. A bit later, we'll talk with Professor Quentin Kidd from Christopher Newport University about what the Electoral College can and cannot do. So we have a fulsome show for you today. And while many are saying the election's a done deal, get over it, others are discovering activism for the first time. Dr. Ralph Young is a professor of history at Temple University. He's the author of Dissent in America, Voices That Shaped a Nation, and Dissent, the History of an American Idea. Professor Young, thanks so much for being with us today.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. So we note that there are a number of protests that have happened. There are a number of protests that are being planned. When you think about the term dissent, how do you define that term?
Oh, well, dissent, you know, that's kind of a complicated issue. I mean, one depends on if you kind of define it broadly. It just basically means going against the grain. But there's more specific examples of it. The main thing that I've discovered in my research and in my writing is that dissent is actually central to American history. You know, just to give a little broad view of this is, you know, you had religious dissenters coming over in the 17th century to set up churches, you know, to worship the way they wanted to. By the 18th century, you had political dissenters, which finally broke with Great Britain so that the United States itself is a product of dissent. And then it was considered so important for the United States that we put it into the First Amendment of the Constitution. And as I always tell my students, Americans haven't shut up since. we've been dissenting about everything.
Yeah.
You had, you know, abolitionists in the 19th century, the women's suffragists, you had workers fighting for the right to unionize. You have the civil rights movement, and of course, all of the movements that have kind of emerged after the 60s, you know, gay rights,
right,
environmentalism, you know, you name it, there's a movement for it. And every war in our nation's history has had protesters. So it's basically, it's in our DNA.
Yeah.
You know, Americans like to dissent from, and it comes from all perspectives, from both the left and the right.
So as you think about, and you just noted a number of moments of dissension in our national history, mm-hmm, from which there have been changes, mm-hmm, have happened.
Yes.
So I wonder,
yes,
as you think about the broad sweep of history, what are some of the characteristics of dissent that you observe changes things? Do you know what I mean? I think there's a lot of conversation about what's meaningful and what's just kind of making noise.
Right. Right. And there have been a lot of dissent movements that have gone nowhere or were kind of set back greatly. I mean, certainly the women's rights, civil rights, you know, even the anti-Vietnam War demonstrations, although it took a long time, I think really helped provoke the end of that war. But, you know, what dissenters, a lot of the successful movements are when dissenters are basically fighting for rights that are guaranteed in the Constitution that they feel they don't have. Like whether it's gay rights or civil rights, or women's rights, those have had a fair amount of success. And one of the things that they've done very cleverly and very effectively is that dissenters will frequently, in their protests, quote from the founding documents, the Declaration and the Constitution. And you know, it's as though these documents are looked at as though they were a contract that the United States signed with its people. You know, you obey our laws and we will protect your rights. And basically dissenters are saying, well, you're not upholding your end of the bargain. You're not protecting our rights. And so they push for that. And I think a lot of those movements have had a significant amount of success. There have been other movements. I mean, like just most recently, take the Occupy movement. A lot of people feel that that didn't go anywhere, and I guess it didn't, but it did have the effect of changing the conversation. Before Occupy, most people were talking about the deficit. After Occupy, everybody's talking about income inequality, the 99% versus the 1%. And even though no changes were made about that, this is now in our public discourse, and maybe 5 years, 10 years from now, maybe that will be addressed. So, you know, when we look at it from a different perspective, perhaps the Occupy movement has had some success.
That's really interesting. So it does change in some respects the way we speak about things. As you look at some of the dissent that is underway right now, there is a women's march coming up the day after the inauguration in Washington, online registration, something like 145,000 for that. Certainly there are the Black Lives Matter protests. I wonder how you would characterize those in this long history that you've spent time looking at.
Yeah, well, just take the women's march that's planned. Well, in 1913, on the day before Woodrow Wilson was inaugurated president, hundreds of thousands of women marched on Washington to demand women's suffrage, you know, women's right to vote. And more people actually attended that demonstration than actually attended the inauguration itself. And then the next day, Alice Paul and some of the other women organizers met with Wilson in the White House and basically said, we want you to support, you know, the Susan B. Anthony Amendment, which was before Congress. And he kind of sort of blew them off. He said, well, you know, I haven't really thought about it. Mm-hmm. And they were really ticked off at that. And shortly thereafter, they started picketing the White House
Interesting.
Kind of on a daily basis.
Yeah.
So this is, it's almost, I think, you know, like 100 years later, history sort of repeating itself, not exactly for the same cause, but basically, the women that are going to be marching on Washington in January are very concerned about setbacks to things like Roe v. Wade, Planned Parenthood, women's rights in general.
Dr. Ralph Young, I want to thank you for joining us today. These are interesting times, and thank you for joining us from Temple University. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Dr. Ralph Young is the author of Dissent in America, Voices That Shaped a Nation, and Dissent, the History of an American Idea. You can follow him on Twitter at ryoung03. We are at 15 minutes past the hour. Pim's on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Pim, you're on the air.
Hello, Kathleen.
Hi.
I'm following up the doctor there, and my subject was more about the cybersecurity.
Sure.
Lack thereof in the,
yeah, what do you think about it?
I think that, personally, I think that they can't, the Democrat Party, I guess, from what it seems to me, can't be trusted with cybersecurity.
How do you figure that? How do you figure that?
Because, well, the Republicans weren't hacked and the Democrats were.
Well, but I think the latest intelligence, the intelligence assessments are that there was information that was perhaps withheld from the Republican hack and it disclosed from the Democratic hack. Thank you for the call. 16 minutes past the hour. It's 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. We should point out that there are a growing number of calls for congressional investigations on this issue, which brings us to Vivian Page, blogger and columnist. You can follow her on Twitter at VPage, P-A-I-G-E. Vivian, good to have you here today. Thank you for being with us.
Glad to be back.
So I know that you are an elector. You are one of those electors that we elected on November 8th. So we definitely want to talk about that that experience for you and what that's been like. Our caller talks about the intelligence briefings and the intelligence findings over the weekend. And one of the things that that people have begun to talk about is, and there are some of your colleagues in the Electoral College who have said, hold up, we would like to have a briefing on these issues before we proceed with the vote on Monday. Is that a good idea? Is it practical? What's your take on that?
Well, you know, I'm of the opinion that this is the world that we live in, not the world that we would like it to be. It is unreasonable to anticipate, to think that there's a way that 538 people could be vetted in order to receive a briefing by Monday. I just think that it's a little bit too much, too little too late in terms from that perspective. But that's not to say that the issues that have been raised are not valid issues. I think that as a country, we should be concerned when we have someone have the appearance of someone, some other country interfering in our elections. That isn't a Republican or a Democratic position. That is an American position that we don't want to have anybody having any influence. We want to be the ones making our own decisions.
I wonder, because one of the other proposals that's come forward, two things I want to ask you about. One is, of course, you are an elector for Hillary Clinton because you are in the state of Virginia, and that's how Virginia voted, right? So
Correct.
We know how you're going to vote. That's no big surprise. There are efforts toward some of your colleagues to get them to change their vote. There are efforts to not vote for Mr. Trump. There are also efforts to convince Democratic lawmakers, Democratic electors, to agree on a consensus Republican candidate in an effort to keep Mr. Trump from 270. What's your take on that?
Well, first of all, any Democratic elector who is voting for anyone other than Hillary Clinton is not taking any electoral votes away from Donald Trump. So I don't understand that particular move. Whether or not there are folks who were elected as electors for Donald Trump who choose to change their vote, that is their choice. So far, we've only heard of two of them. One who actually resigned rather than cast his electoral vote for Donald Trump, and one who has said that he will not be voting for Donald Trump. So the effort underway to change what would take 37 electors to actually change their votes away from Donald Trump. So far, we've got one, and today is
and
Tuesday.
Next Monday is coming
up. And Monday
yep.
is the vote.
Yeah.
So I honestly don't see that happening. I just don't see how it can possibly happen. One of the things that people have to remember is that electors, although there's 13 of us here in Virginia, and we've had one conference call, we do not communicate.
Y'all aren't hanging out in smoke-filled rooms or anything.
No, we're not. No, and we do not communicate across state lines. I mean, I've been, it's not been a secret that I am an elector, as evidenced by the emails that I've been receiving.
I've seen your name on a lot of lists. Yeah.
So, but I haven't talked to any elector from another state. And I think that the idea that this is that we have this national election, we do have a national election, but it's only a national election from the standpoint that we add the numbers together. Mm-hmm. We have 51 separate elections under 51 separate sets of rules. How electors are chosen from one state to the next varies. So what the requirements are for those electors. We've got 29 states that have laws that say that the electors must vote for the popular candidate, but, you know, that law really hasn't been tested, so therefore
and
we
the
don't.
And the penalties are not
Well, I mean, the penalties in some places are $1,000 if you don't do it, and there have been. So the question, here's the thing for me. The thing for me is this is the system that we held this election under. Okay.
So if we want to change
it. We want to change it. We can't change it now because here's the rules that we all signed up for when we did this. So our time to have this conversation is over between now and the next presidential election. And I say now and the next because I really mean over the next 2 years.
Right.
Because the next presidential election actually starts in about 2 years.
I think it started actually today.
Yeah. It actually started November 9th, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
So we need to have this conversation about what we're going to do and how we're going to handle things and how is it possible within the law to modify the Electoral College? How is it possible for us? I mean, these are the conversations we need to be having, and we don't need to be having them after. It's like closing the barn door after the horse is already out. I think that's how that thing goes.
Right. And so let me just ask you that, because you are an elector and you have made a very cogent call to sort of look at this in the next 2 years. If you want to look at it, that's the time to do it. A lot of people said that, by the way, after 2000.
Right, but it's like we forgot.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
2000 rolled around
done.
And 16 years later, we still haven't
Here
done
we
anything.
Are. So I guess the one question I wonder about from you is, we know what the role of the Electoral College is. Is the Electoral College still relevant?
Absolutely.
In a country where we are so connected nationally?
I think that it's extremely relevant. I think that the problem that is in the administration, that really and truthfully, we've got several ways of making the Electoral College be a better representative than it is now. My biggest issue has to be with the winner-take-all nature of the Electoral College. There's no rule that says it has to be winner-take-all. It's just that's what the states have adopted. As I said before, you have to understand that this is 51 separate elections, 50 states plus D.C. These are separate elections. The fight is actually, the argument has to do with your state legislators, because there's no reason why we have to do winner take all. If we didn't do winner take all, the Electoral College could be done differently. And so that's a part of what we have to look at. I don't know that the process of eliminating the Electoral College requires a constitutional amendment. And passing a constitutional amendment in this country is a daunting task.
Let me share with you some of the comments from our Facebook page. Madam Elector. Margaret writes, shame on your guest for not speaking to her other electors to understand why Democratic electors are willing to put forth a bipartisan alternative. The point is coming together of an acceptable alternative. And she says that the system is in place if the electors have the nerve to use it.
That is not true. There is no national system of electors. The electors are done on a state-by-state basis, so it's not a matter of me not saying, oh, I'm not going to reach out to them. Do you know how many electors there are in that Hamilton group that have come up with, let's vote for a consensus candidate?
I'd say maybe...
There's 10 total.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Nine of them are Democrats.
I was going to say, I thought there were nine Democrats.
So we're talking out of 538. Part of the process for me has been, I really do feel like we need to have a civics conversation about how our elections work and how the Electoral College works, so that people can understand it's not as simple as it sounds.
I hear you. One of our posters, Linda, says, if Trump is a national security risk, then we have no other choice. And what I think she's speaking to is the concern we do hear from a fair number of folks who are very concerned about what they have seen between Election Day and the present moment. We outlined some of that at the start of the show. And I hear everything you're saying about the timing on this, which needed to be before and not now. Got it. The awkwardness of this in terms of what would need to happen in order for any changes to be made. I got that. What do you say to people, though, like Linda, who are very concerned about what they've seen since election day?
I'm as concerned as she is. That doesn't change. The process is you're preaching. It becomes a preaching to the choir kind of thing. the reaching out has got to take place in those states where the electors happen to be Republican, because they are the only one. They have this in their hands. This is their choice to make,
not the Democratic states.
And so part of the understanding is that. I get an email that says, tells me to honor the popular vote. Well, that's exactly what I'm doing, because Hillary Clinton won Virginia. So send your email to somebody else,
yeah,
in terms of, from a process standpoint,
sure,
to understand that's where the reaching out has to come from. It has to be the public, if they're really interested, need to go into those states where those 306 electoral votes are, that are going to give him the majority.
So I never asked you this before. Have you been an elector before?
No.
Okay, so this is your first.
Yes.
Well done. Timing is everything. What has that process been like? Because we are hearing that electors, I mean, your names are publicly available, which,
sure.
Wow. And you've probably been receiving emails and the like.
Well, I think that I personally think that maybe we need to rethink the way we choose electors, but that's another whole argument.
Yeah.
In terms, from a process standpoint, the deadline for me to apply was like back in March.
Okay.
Okay. And so I was selected at a convention in May. So it's been a long time,
yeah,
and there really hasn't been, you know, a whole lot of stuff in terms of process until after the election. And then because of the very nature of the way things are and how we do it in Virginia. And again, I don't know how they do it in every state, because
sure,
I live in Virginia. But we have a slate of electors for each party that appeared on the ballot.
Exactly.
So therefore,
you say you're voting for the electors,
right,
for.
Right. Yeah. So the electors, the Democrats happen to have won Virginia, so the Democratic slate is the electors. But if you go to the State Board of Elections website, you will actually see there's five or six different slates of electors, because each party that was on the ballot, so the Libertarians had their own, and the McMullen, I think is his name,
yeah,
had his own slate, and the Republicans. So everybody has their own slate. But every state is doing this differently. And so it's not a national question it is a national question from the standpoint of how this is done. But because of the very nature of elections being administered by the states, then
it really is
a 50-state process.
So if you
51, including D.C.,
if you were queen of the universe, and Vivian, many times I think of you that way.
Well, I appreciate that.
How would you change the electoral college?
I would change it by allocating the electoral college votes proportionally.
That would be the biggest
change.
And
so to me, I would have the states, of course, you can't mandate this because the states are responsible for,
sure,
doing their thing. We have, of the 51 jurisdictions, only two of them have any allocation of electoral college votes other than winner take all. Maine and Nebraska allocate by a congressional district. I think allocating by congressional district is problematic because of the gerrymandering of congressional districts. So from my perspective, an allocation of the electoral college electors would be done on a proportional basis based on the popular vote. And if we had done that, I mean, they've already done this work from 2012. If we look at the numbers and had done it on electoral college, had allocated them by congressional district, Mitt Romney would have actually won the presidential election in 2012. He would have picked up 68 electoral votes whilst losing the popular vote by over 5 million votes. I don't think is what we intend to happen. If we had done proportionally, then about 50 electoral votes would have been, President Obama would have lost about 50, 49 of those would have gone to Romney, and one actually would have gone to the Libertarian candidate.
Wow.
So we don't have.
So all of these have consequences.
We have to think it through and spend some time figuring out how to do it best, but that's how I would do it.
Ryan is on the line from Portsmouth. Hi, Ryan. Thanks for holding.
Hey there. I just had this question about what they call faithless electors.
Yes.
I've heard about it in the news. A couple of electors will say, hey, I'm deciding to vote my conscience.
Yes.
Even though Trump won, I'm not going to vote for him. Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't the elector supposed to be nothing more than a representative of the voice of the people in that state? I mean, shouldn't they their conscience really should come into play, and don't they know that going into it? Mm.
Ryan, that's actually, there's a... Go ahead.
I think that when you look historically at representative government, and certainly look at it historically from the Electoral College standpoint, the founders certainly didn't intend that to be the case. They intended for the electors to actually vote their conscience. But let me just step that back and also say that when you elect a representative to Congress, the person who goes, and I can remember my congressional representative telling me once that it was not her job to actually represent the popular vote of the people. It was her job to with additional information to make the best choice for the people. So if that's the case, I mean, if you have people in Congress who believe that they are voting their conscience, right, that's part of what they do, is that they actually, because they have more information than the average bear, that's the theory, then I don't see how you can hold electors to any different standard. So my sense is that electors, by definition, and certainly looking at Federalist 68, says that we should be voting our conscience.
Thank you for the call. I see some calls coming in, and I appreciate that. I'm going to ask you to hold those calls for just a few moments. We're going to take a quick check-in with Pledge Central. We'll be back on the other side with your calls. You can line up now, which I would heartily suggest you do. By the way, this is not the pledge number. This is the studio number, 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240.
Thank you very much, Kathy Lewis. Okay, folks, here's where we are. Here's the number. Jason, the number is?
The number is we need $2,474 to make our daily goal of $25,000, ladies and gentlemen. We've raised
$22,000. We can do that. We can do that.
Come on, we got it. We got it right here.
About a four-minute break here. That's all that we need to get to the daily goal of $25,000. So those of you out there listening, here are the numbers to call: 889-9476. 1-800-940-7170, or point, click, and contribute whrv.org. Let's hit $25,000 in this break.
Now we can absolutely do this. And what it would take, it could take two Leadership Circle members. What's the Leadership Circle, you ask? Well, that's someone who decides to become a sustaining member of the show, of the program, rather, and of the station, rather, and it's a $100 a month.
We'll make you a sustaining member of the
show. Yeah, we'll make you we'll absolutely make absolutely. You a sustaining member. So $100 a month makes a $1,200 contribution to the station, and that would be great. Or a whole bunch of many hands make light work. We could get a lot of people calling
absolutely.
In right now. We appreciate anything that you can give to the station right now.
Because it's important. And you know why it's important. We don't have to stand here and tell you that.
They know they're listening to the show. They know why it's important. They're listening to it. It's Kathy Lewis.
It's exactly right. And so we've had so much fun this morning. We started with fascism to throwing away Christmas cards to Russians hacking and influencing the presidential election. What an emotional swing in 3 hours. It's crazy.
I know. But you know, when you tune in here, that you're going to get both sides of the story, and you know that you're going to get, factual news, which is crazy that there's non-factual news, which I just never would even put news at the end of that. But
it's like in the definition of that fiction.
Yeah, I think so. There's a couple of those. Well,
factual news.
Real quickly, let's thank Nancy and Sam McPhail from Newport News for becoming for contributing today. They're new members of WHRV, and they had a little comment here. Always our source for factual and meaningful information. Ripped from the headlines. There you go, right there.
Yeah, and they called us at 889-9476 or 1-800-940-7170, or they went on their computer and they contributed at whrv.org. I'm still boggled by this whole concept of fake news. I mean, is that called an oxymoron?
I think that's exactly what an oxymoron is. But
it's
so
like
that's
tiny
why
giant.
Yeah,
giant. It doesn't work.
But that's why it's important. That's why a show like this and a station like this is so important, because you know it's trustworthy. It has a proven track record. You know when you tune in, you're going to get both sides of the story. You're going to get something that's presented to you, and you know it's been vetted already. It's just not an opinion. And that's one of the reasons why we love the Kathy Lewis show. She takes the time to really find the right people to speak to about the subject so that we can all become just as informed as we need to be.
Well, I heard someone say something this weekend, it's very true, that information doesn't equal wisdom. And so you have to be very careful about the information that you're getting. And one of the things that you know that you're getting on this station is good information.
Definitely.
Information that you can rely upon to form your opinions or think about or influence your thought processes, which is exactly why you're listening to this station. So we need you today to call and consider becoming a sustaining member, but we will take anything that fits your budget at this point in your life. Wait a minute. What do we
have?
Oh,
look at that. That's
up.
Right. Here you go. If you for a $120 one-time contribution or a $10 a month sustaining member contribution, we'll get you a set of two of these wonderful public.
How many?
Two of them. You
What's
get
the
two,
price for that?
It's a $10 monthly
You're
sustainer. Sustainer. That's true. Membership or $120 one time. You get these two public radio nerd.
This real glass, guys.
It's real glass. You can put real beverages in that glass. You can choose what beverage you want.
But now, wait a minute. There's a second part to this.
Oh, that's right. You can double it up. Go $20 a month or $240, and we'll give you four of them, a set of four. So that means, Greg, you and three of your buddies.
Wow, me and three of my buddies?
Yeah, get to drink out of those sweet, sweet pint glasses.
Unbelievable. So all you have to do is call 889-9476 or 1-800-940-7170 or point, click, and contribute at whrv.org. Thank you so much.
Going back.
Twenty-two minutes before the hour, we're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240, and we are interested in what you're thinking about all the things that we're talking about today. There is no shortage of issues to discuss in regard to the transition to a new president. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Dave is on the line from Williamsburg. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Yes.
Hi, Dave. Thanks for holding. You're welcome.
A real quick question. My understanding early on with the founders with respect to the electors was that one of the reasons that electors were selected was that they were supposed to be able to represent the knowledge of our candidates, whereby our citizens were much less informed, you know, during the early days of the 18th century when our electoral college was set up. Wonder if anybody would have any comments on, you know, how that remains pertinent.
Dave, it's an interesting question, and I thank you for the call. When you go back to this Federalist 68, you see that Alexander Hamilton, or Alexander as I like to call him, talked about a couple of things. One was stopping a demagogue from becoming president, saying that he wanted the electors to prevent those with, quote, talents for low intrigue and the little arts of popularity from becoming president. Anyone who would, quote, convulse the community with any extraordinary or violent movements. Then he also wrote that another purpose was to stop what he called the desire in foreign powers to gain an improper ascendant in our council, guard against all danger of this sort with the most provident and judicious attention from the electors. And then the third test was, or the third thing he wanted to do, the third goal was good governance. The true test of good government is its aptitude and tendency to produce a good administration. And for that reason, he said that electors should be able to estimate the share which the executive and every government must necessarily have in its goodwill or administration.
Yeah, I mean, I can only speak for myself in terms of what electors' role should be, and that is I've basically spent an awful lot of time not only reading the Federal 68 and refreshing my memory on those things, but also getting a historical perspective, which I've kind of tried through my newspaper columns to share that information with the public. I think that certainly one of the things that to the original question that he talks about, that they were supposed to be smarter or certainly having more information, is that the founders also really warned us against political parties. And the fact that our process now is developed based on political parties, and that is basically primarily to reduce the possibility of having more people vote their conscience as opposed to voting party-wise. I think that that's something that we need to look at. I mean, I think that this whole idea of the Electoral College and the way it is currently configured is something that we need to be having a conversation about. And so if you don't, if you really do, if you believe in how the founders set things up and the concern about political parties being the dominant force in our system, then we need to have that conversation. We really need to say, do we need to have a process for choosing electors that is not party-based? Do we need to have a process so that they really are put in a position to kind of be more independent and in their thought and stuff? Do we need to revisit how the states are actually doing this? Now, what I said to you, I don't know how they're doing it in the other 50 jurisdictions, right? So I'm only saying this from a perspective that folks actually have to try to figure out a way to how can we make this system better? And we need, this is great that we're having this conversation. I want the conversation to continue.
19 minutes before the hour, lots of comments on our Facebook page. David writes, he thinks the CIA findings make it clear that Putin tipped the scales, combining with Comey's false alarm that shifted momentum and damaged Clinton's clear lead in all the major polls prior to that episode occurring. This election has been an injustice and cannot be allowed to stand. I don't know how to pronounce this name. Another poster said, get over it. More useless airwaves. 16 minutes before the hour. Lest we be useless, we should bring Quentin Kidd into the conversation, right? Quentin Kidd is a professor of political science, director of the Wasson Center for Public Policy at Christopher Newport University. Quentin, good to talk with you again.
Good to talk to you. I'm glad to lower the intellectual level of the conversation just a little bit.
Well done. I know you've been listening to what Vivian is saying. She's an elector in the Electoral College. She's saying, look, the time for this conversation was probably after 2000, first of all, but it most assuredly is not in this current scenario where we have an Electoral College vote on Monday. Where do you stand on that?
There's very little that Vivian has said so far that I disagree with. In fact, I can't think of any main point that she's made that I disagree with. I mean, she's right about all of these things. These are state. We have 51 elections that go on. Every state has slightly different rules. Every state has slightly different requirements, parties. Some parties are stronger in some states, weaker in other states. I mean, the whole nine yards. I think I agree. The time to deal with this is after the election. You can't essentially change the rules as the process is happening. I mean, that just leads down a path that nobody is going to be happy with. This is a fundamental question. The founders created an Electoral College. Essentially, not so much because they distrusted the intellect of voters, but because they weren't sure voters would have all the information they needed to have, and they distrusted other institutions like political parties, and they distrusted powerful agents of other governments, and they just weren't sure that news traveled up and down the Eastern Seaboard at that time fast enough for people to be able to have all the information they needed to vote the way they would, to cast an informed vote. And so they looked for institutions that would inform how they could do this. And they looked to two institutions in particular. And one was the College of Cardinals that the Roman Catholic Church had used for hundreds of years to select popes. And the other one was the centurial assembly that the Roman Republic had used to elect leaders of the Roman Republic. And they said, in both instances, we have processes, colleges, as they were called, to essentially send delegates to cast the vote for who the leader would be. And they thought that model would work in this new democratic republic that didn't have a speedy process for delivering information up and down the Eastern Seaboard, but wanted the views of people heard.
Yeah. 15 minutes before the hour. Quentin, I want to ask you, and we asked Vivian a version of this in the first half. So here's what I'm hearing on Facebook and conversations and all over the place. Some people believe that the Electoral College vote should be delayed pending the revelation of this intelligence, a presentation from the intelligence community. Vivian says not possible, you know, probably not going to happen. But other people are saying, look, and this one of the electors said this, they're so alarmed by what they've been seeing since Election Day that there's a concern about endorsing this vote. They're concerned about cabinet appointments. They're concerned about this news about the presidential briefings that are a daily thing. And President-elect Trump says he'll do that on a weekly basis, and he's available if he needs to be contacted about that. The fact that there's not yet a plan to eliminate the conflicts of interest that have been discussed widely. And all of this has people saying, look, this is an unprecedented moment in our national history. So my question for you, Dr. Political Science, is this an unprecedented moment? And as a political scientist, how do you respond to those concerns of people who have said, whoa, there's a lot that's happened between Election Day and the present that is very concerning?
It's not unprecedented in the sense that we had a very contentious election that after votes were cast and counted, people had major disagreements with. That's happened multiple times in the history of our country. It isn't unprecedented in the sense that electors are saying they're going to vote, cast electoral votes differently than the direction that their states went. That's happened multiple times in the history of our country. It is unprecedented in the sense that we have far more information about what's going on in the transition office of the president-elect than we've ever had in the history of our country. There are many, many instances in the history of our country where presidents didn't have their cabinet appointments made till months into them taking office. What's happening right now is that some of the conflicts related to the Electoral College and related to elections that we've had over the years in our history, we're having now, but they're taking place in an environment where we have so much more information instantaneously. I mean, we practically wake up in the morning and know what Donald Trump ate for breakfast. You know, I mean, we have that much information, and that's part of what's making it's like it's ratcheting up the anxiety of things that aren't that abnormal, but because we hear about them instantaneously, they make us far more anxious about what's going on.
Interesting point. So different times, modern technology, a lot has changed. So I want to ask you the same question I asked Vivian earlier as well. Given that, given what you have just described, does this two-step process, popular vote, electoral college, does it still work? And are there adjustments that you would propose or suggest as a result of what you've just described?
Well, we can see that it doesn't work seamlessly. I mean, we're seeing problems with it. I mean, I agree with Vivian that we can't, you know, somehow if we want individual votes to matter more than they do, somehow we need to have a way where electors can represent, you know, votes in a better way than we have. I agree. I don't think the congressional district method is the best way to do it because right now, the country is gerrymandered pretty heavily, and so you've got problems on that context. So this requires a lot of thinking and a lot of debate and deliberation to figure out how to do it. I mean, the founders considered popular vote, just letting presidents be elected by popular vote. Their concern was, remember, back in the late 1700s, early 1800s, people's primary allegiances were to their states, and so the fear was that people would vote for somebody from their state, and we would end up having, you know, nobody win the popular vote, and 12 different people win a lot of votes from different states. And so, you know, there's no easy answer. If we want to go to popular election of the president, however, what we have to recognize is that we're changing an electoral process that involves 51 states, and we're making it a singular process. And I'm not convinced that people fully comprehend that really changes the fundamental nature of the Democratic Republic that we have. It fundamentally says states then don't play a formidable role in the process of electing presidents like they did in the past. There would be no reason to have state elections at that point.
And it also changes the dynamic in terms of our process representing the fact that, you know, yes, you have some very populous states. We would literally have candidates that run for office that never come to states that don't have the population in them. I mean, this is a fundamental shift in the way we elect our president if we went to a popular vote. There are ways that we can do a better job, but to think that the majority rules without any consideration of the minority, which is why I'm so against this winner-take-all thing, because it basically says that you know, here in Virginia, where Hillary Clinton won Virginia, that we are not giving any voice to the people who voted for Donald Trump. I don't think that's fair. I don't think that that's what the 14th Amendment and the Equal Protection Clause says. So I think that, you know, we need to be doing something different. But am I willing to say that we should do it by popular vote? No, I won't go that far.
By the way, not late breaking news, but another development is that the Department of Energy said today that it is rejecting the request by the Trump transition team to name the staffers who worked on climate change programs. Everett's on the line from Suffolk. Hi, Everett. You're on the air.
Hi. I was just wondering if enough electors change their vote and neither Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton have 270 electoral votes, what happens then?
The vote is... Go ahead,
then the
Clinton.
House of Representatives picks the president.
Correct.
And that's happened before.
Yep, it has.
Not in recent memory, but yes.
Correct.
Everett, did that do it for you?
Yeah, thank you.
You're welcome. Take care. I think Everett's question was a really interesting one because, and boy, this is what I love about this show, is we don't have to, we just ask the questions, right? So, you know, there's a lot of information, a lot of detail out there. So this is part of how we have that conversation that Vivian's describing and that Quentin's describing is, ask if you don't know. That's
absolutely
a great opportunity.
Absolutely.
To do that. Yes.
I mean, you know, I still laugh over the fact that when I announced that I had been selected as an elector, and
yes,
I basically put a little comment on my Facebook page that said, I'm honored to be chosen as an elector.
Yeah.
And everybody went, congratulations. And they went, what's an elector? So, you know, I mean, I got phone calls and emails from people going, I don't know what that is.
Not so, that's okay.
So, and that's fine with me. I mean, I'm happy to explain to the best of my ability what the role of an elector is. And certainly, like I said before, I spent a lot of time actually studying because I take it's anything that I take on, I take seriously to actually try to inform myself as much as I can. But this is a basic part of, I don't think that was, I think his question was exactly dead on.
Yes.
We need to have that kind of knowledge and knowledge questions come up. Absolutely.
And Kathy, let me say, there is one area of uncharted territory that we may find ourselves in after Monday, and that is the Supreme Court has held that states can require electors to to be bound, essentially, that there's no restriction on putting a requirement on an elector about how they'll vote, right? And so Virginia does that. Virginia says, you know, you've got to vote the will of the people, as Vivian knows. There is no case where an elector has been charged and tried and convicted for violating that. Some states have rules that say, look, if you vote against your pledge, then the other electors can come together and essentially nullify your vote and replace you, right? So there is some of that going on, but we may for the first time be in a situation where a state charges an elector with violating a state law that says they have to vote the will of the people. That would be uncharted territory.
Yeah.
I think that's an important point to keep in mind. I don't know whether that will happen. It may. I tend to think we're going to have fewer unfaithful electors than we think we are right now. The second thing that I think people should keep in mind, this goes to the educated, you know, the good question part of this. The Electoral College was envisioned at a time when political parties were not part of the way we practice politics in America nationally, and the Electoral College didn't envision the way the political parties have come to control this process.
Mm.
And I think any discussion about a reform has to clearly has to take into consideration that political parties are an important institution that that will not be going away, and they have to be accounted for in this process.
Really interesting. So to that point, Quentin Kidd, and I want to ask, Vivian posed this in the last segment. She said, we have to start a conversation about party-based politics, right?
I mean, actually, because Quentin is dead on in that process, and I've been in my own brain as I started thinking about using a proportional popular vote. We would end up with, you know, like 7-6 in terms of electors for and it would have been in 2012, I think it was 5 for Romney and 8 for Barack Obama. How do you actually choose which people are going to be there? How do you figure out, I mean, with our winner-take-all system, you know, Hillary Clinton takes Virginia, then all the electors are. So how do you figure out, if you split the vote 7-6, how do you figure out how do you make that decision? And that's an interesting question to me. I can think of a number of different ways to do it, but that's an interesting question, and we do have to figure that all out.
Let's see. Butch is on the line now from Norfolk. Hi, Butch. You're on the air.
Hey, so my name is Butch Brown. I'm from Norfolk. My question is this, or it's kind of a half question, half statement. If the House, if the electors did not vote 270 for Trump in the race when it actually did go over to the House, couldn't you make a pretty decent argument that it would actually strengthen Donald Trump's mandate? In other words, it would sort of take the teeth out of this argument that Hillary Clinton won the popular vote and therefore she should be the president of the United States. Because the people's house will have been voted.
Mm. It's an interesting point, Butch, and I thank you for the call. And Quentin Kidd, I don't think anybody is suggesting that if it went to the House, there wouldn't be a Republican emerge from that process, right?
Yeah. I don't think it would strengthen Trump's hand in the sense that that Butch was talking about, because it would be in the midst of or in the context of a lot of controversy. And the reality, the fact is that Hillary Clinton will have probably won the national vote, will have probably gotten close to 3 million more votes than Trump. And so that always is going to be a shadow that looms over Trump's presidency. So I don't think it would change any of that. It would really just inject more controversy, I think.
Butch, I thank you for the call. I've got one last question for you from our Facebook page, from one of our posters who says, I find it terrifying that President-elect Trump will not agree to press conferences, but will meet with Kanye West. That happened this morning. I would really appreciate a discussion of this, because it seems to be yet another way he is trampling all over our First Amendment rights. I'm talking about now the delay of the press conference to an unspecified date in January. Quentin, have at it. You got 10 seconds, and then I'll come to Vivian.
It's tactical. I'm not bothered by that. I mean, this is all tactical. In the end, Trump is going to have to govern. He's going to have to be a president, and that's what we need to evaluate him on.
Totally agree.
Wow, that was easy cheesy. Hey, thanks, Vivian, for stopping
by. Glad to be here.
I wish you well on Monday when you do your civic duty, and I bet you didn't think all this was going to happen.
No.
Quentin Kidd, thank you.
Let me just wish Vivian good luck on Monday.
Yeah, indeed, as we all do. Quentin, thank you for being with us today.
Thanks,
from Christopher Newport. Always a pleasure. Thank you for your thoughts and your calls as well. We'll continue our conversations called After the Vote each week here on Hearsay. Thanks for listening. We'll see you right back here tomorrow.